Voila.
It is my pleasure to welcome the participants in this panel, our first panel in quite a while, it seems to me. Two of whom have been on panels in this store before. One is new to our stage, and I am delighted to welcome Kathleen Robiano to the Many Rivers Books and Tea stage. She is a member of a Roman Catholic secular Franciscan order, minister for the Sonoma County Il Poverello fraternity, which I hope we'll hear a little bit about, just because I don't know what that means, and we'll look forward to hearing about. Her background includes work in the healing fields of nursing, midwifery, and dance, and her mission is to be a presence of the love, healing, and peace of Christ. Our own Jim Wilson studied Buddhism in Korea and Japan. He is a former monk and abbot of a temple in New York and is currently a member of the local Quaker meeting here in Sebastopol. He works here at Many Rivers, of course, and spends much of his free time writing poetry and has his own poetry blog, shapingwords.blogspot.com. And last but definitely not least is Miosho Virginia Matthews, who has spoken here many, many times to our delight. She is a Rinzai lay ordained nun in the Zen Buddhist lineage of Joshu Sasaki Roshi, and her teacher, who was her teacher since 73, a professional dancer, teacher, offering, as I know personally, Pilates, dance classes, and Zen meditation for women at her studio downtown dance art space just down the street here, and is deeply committed to partnership, family, and community for life. So thank you all for coming to speak on a topic dear to my own heart, which I look forward to hearing what you have to say about. Welcome.
So I volunteered to go first because this actually was my idea to pull in members of the community that I knew who were deeply engaged in the contemplative life. And this is something that has been I've been steeped since childhood in this longing for a contemplative life, though I didn't have those words for it when I was a young girl. But I did reach for it in the sense of growing up in a household of Jewish atheists. There was no nurturance for that yearning. And I remember going into my room and lighting candles, mm-hmm. and I think I picked up an old hymnal from a church I had visited, and I was a musician, so I sang hymns, and I made my own rituals, mm-hmm. in my little room, mm-hmm. with the door closed so my mommy and daddy wouldn't know what I was doing up there. And I didn't understand that there was even a path of dedication to looking for the divine, or searching, or longing, or practicing, whatever those words were. I didn't have, these were the 50s. Mm-hmm. These were the 50s. And so I was also feeling apart. Luckily, I didn't matter so much. I just spent my time with the trees. I heard voices. I had amazing dreams. And somehow, if I didn't talk about it, nobody told me that either I was crazy, wrong, or should be doing something else. So I actually managed to stay in a rather intimate relationship with the divine on my own terms. And I feel really fortunate that I had that. Of course, I hit adolescence. Terrible time. That's when you find out this is not okay. And this is when the voices stopped, and when you didn't get to just wander around the park with the trees. And I went through an incredible spiritual crisis. And it wasn't unusual for people who go through that. Now I really understand to self-medicate, and at a very young age I became practically an alcoholic. And there's a word, there's a reason they call alcohol spirits. So it was a spiritual crisis that I didn't know, and I was trying to solve that crisis with spirits. Not the best way. But this was the late 60s, and suddenly LSD appeared, and mushrooms, and yoga, and Zen, and suddenly my, what I thought was just my own private intimate relationship with the divine that got blasted apart was validated. And so I started to understand that I could, through these practices, perhaps nurture this relationship with the divine. So I entered a Zen practices. But at the same time, I had also discovered art. Art seemed to be the way that I could nourish my inner life. It seemed the most socially acceptable at the time in college and high school and college. And so I became immersed in my art form of dance, found Zen, fell in love with my high school boyfriend, got married, and there I was, embarked on a threefold path of a dance career, commitment to this teacher and these practices, contemplative practice, and family life, partnership, and then three boys followed. All the while struggling with how do I keep this intimate relationship with the mystery. It was very easy at the Zen Center. It was very easy to get into that place of deep quiet and total focus on one's inner life. And then to emerge from that into the world was extremely difficult. I never did figure out how to do it. It was always a yearning that never quite left me. I did my practices at home. I was definitely, Zen was very practical. I could get into my inner life as I chopped the carrots, as I changed the baby's diapers. But that uninterrupted immersion was seemingly impossible in the midst of what in India they call householder life. So it always felt like my inner monastic was not happy. I know I grew as a person in my family life. I knew that these practices were deepening through cutting the carrots, or as we say in Zen, chop wood, carry water. I knew that these were important practices. And yet, I could never quite reconcile how to live in both worlds. They seem like two different worlds. They still seem a bit like two different worlds. I went even deeper into the monastic practice by ordaining. So even though I was lay ordained, in my sangha, you still take the same vows and you're expected to serve the sangha in many of the same ways. I never had the luxury to live at the center, which is one reason I still have hair. If you live at the center, you shave your head. But I did receive the robes. And to me, it's a very interesting process. Is when I go to the center, I put on my monastic robes, and they have a lot of symbolism. My teacher, when he gives you the robe, saying this is a visible manifestation of your bodhisattva vow. And for those of you who know in Buddhism, It's a particular vow that ordained people, and even now not necessarily ordained, but people who want to commit to Buddhist practice take the Bodhisattva vow, which is basically one of service. So, as my teacher said, every time you put on the karoma, the outer robe, it is to remind you that you have made this vow to be of service. So here I am now at this cusp of family life is gone. Forest dweller time means you're kind of removing yourself from the world. But does it mean that the next step is a renunciate? Does it mean that traditionally this would be the time that people who had family life could finish with that and go to the mountain and enter into the deep relationship with the divine? And I'm not sure that's what's called for in the world right now. Perhaps this real service is to stay in the world and nourish that relationship and bring it out. And it's a new way of contemplative life. I don't think we've seen it. Suzuki Roshi said, the fact that, he was talking to his ordained people, the fact that you are not quite monks, that's not such a problem. But the fact that you're not really lay people, that's a little more difficult. And you are going to have to find out what that is. And he really saw that as our generation is going to take these practices that came from the East into a different direction. And I think we have a wealth of wisdom in our community that I hope we can share, of how to bring the contemplative life fully into the world so that inner monastic gets nourished. So thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn it over to Kay.
The Lord give you peace. And that was the greeting that St. Francis suggested that his followers use when they went out to see people. And I'll just briefly tell you what a secular Franciscan is, and then sort of very briefly about Francis, and then how I make sense of that in the world right now. You know, it's not unlike what you were describing, Ginny. In the Roman Catholic tradition, there are different religious orders. Some of you may be aware of that. And the religious orders are typically Jesuits, Dominicans, Franciscans, there's Trappists. There's more that I've not mentioned. But and then in those religious orders, there are often priests, brothers, nuns, and in some of them there are lay people. And in the time of St. Francis, there were people that wanted to support the work of Francis with the poor and those who were marginalized in the community and wanted to follow his way of peace, yet they didn't want to commit to be a brother or, you know, a sister with Claire. So since the time of Francis, there have always been lay people trying to follow his footsteps, follow in that charism. So currently, here in Sonoma County, there's a fraternity, they call them fraternities, little groups, and then there's regional, and then there's national, and there's international groups, and we meet once a month in Petaluma. And so we are trying to be in the world and living a spiritually committed life, and we too have a type of vows or promises that we make similar to some of the religious orders you've heard of, poverty, chastity, obedience, which have broader meanings for the lay people that are following those ways in some ways. But to help you understand the challenge of that, I thought I would just read a couple of passages that when Francis, for those of you who aren't familiar with St. Francis, he lived in Italy in the early 1200s. He was from a wealthy family, very Catholic wealthy family. His dad was a merchant. He went off to fight in some of the wars that were going on in Italy. He was imprisoned at one point. He became sick. And there was a point where he went on sort of his own journey of searching, and people in the community thought he had gone mad. And then one day he was in an old sort of desolate church that had broken down outside of Assisi, and he heard a voice saying, Francis, go rebuild my house, because as you see, it's in ruins. At first he thought he meant that God wanted him to rebuild this particular church, and then later on he discovered it meant something else. And what he did is, the first man that came to join him, they took the Bible and they opened it three times to find out what it was that they were being led to follow. So the first thing that they opened to was, Jesus told him, if you seek perfection, go sell your possessions and give to the poor. You will then have treasure in heaven. Afterward, come back and follow me. The second was, the gift you have received, give as gift. Provide yourselves with neither gold nor silver nor copper in your belts, no traveling bag, no change of shirt, no sandals, no walking staff. The workman, after all, is worth his keep. And then the third passage they opened to was, Jesus said to all, whoever wishes to be my follower must deny his very self, take up his cross each day, and follow in my steps. And that was the beginning of Francis's work in the world with the poor, and he was trying his best to imitate the Christ that he got to know through his contemplative practice, through his time in prayer. And the thing that's very interesting about the Franciscan way of being is it's not only contemplative, but it also includes action. And that the contemplation is what helps lead to the action, and then the action takes you back to really reflect and then try to deepen the practice. And we strive to bring that concept of, you know, what was Jesus asking people to do in the gospel? No matter what your spiritual practice or background, I think most people would recognize Jesus as someone who really brought a presence of love to the world and gave an example of something that that the world was very hungry for. And the Franciscan theology around it is quite different than what you maybe hear and what I heard growing up. And we heard, you know, that Jesus came to the earth and he died on the cross for our sins. Well, that was Thomas Aquinas, and I found out just in the last couple of years that there's a Franciscan theologian, John Duns Scotus, who really was emphasizing how Christ came just to show us love, just to show us how to be love in the world, and that his death was just following through on his act of love in the world. And certainly in our own times we see that in many places, where people are putting their life on the line because of the love they have in whatever setting that they're in. So my Franciscan calling, so to speak, also was influenced by my life on several reservations, Native reservations, and that incredible you know, the traditional respect for life on the earth and the creatures and all of that. And Francis is seen, you know, with the bird bath, so typically, right? But he preached to the creatures. He loved everything of creation. And he saw everything as a manifestation of the Creator. And so I used to spend time with the trees too, Ginny. I mean, you know, when things are bad at home, I'd go climb a tree and I'd just be there in the quiet. And the Franciscans that I met along my way were very interesting to me. And it was a long journey of, you know, finally deciding I was going to take this lay practice and make something of it. And then by default, I've just become the, quote, minister for our local group, which, you know, it's a leadership role, but it's really about servant leadership. And just like Jesus' example of washing the feet of his disciples, that's the ideal of my role in a leadership role. The challenge in the world is that there's many distractions from following the path that, you know, and discerning what's a distraction and what's something that's showing me another aspect of God and something that's serving. Because like you've talked about service, that's a very important thing. And our special service is, you know, that call to the poor and the marginalized and those who may be thinking they're really nothing in the world, but that's our special call, is to be with all people. Francis made no judgments about people, whether they were rich or poor, and that's our call, to not be in judgment of anyone, but to especially help those who are on the margins discover the beauty of themselves and to be, you know, brothers and sisters to them. As we finish our own sharing here, you know, we hope that also you may share about what it's like in your own spiritual practice. What are the things that, you know, call you, and what are the things that are distracting, and how do we, you know, make a better world, whatever our practice is and however we find our way in that. So that's a little bit in a nutshell there.
Thank you. I really resonated with Jenny's depiction of, like, it feels like there's two worlds, you know, like, and there's this world of, I call it the presence of eternity. You know, like, and then there's this world of constant change and turmoil and distraction, and like Jenny, I have not really been able to reconcile the two. I have not been able to figure that tug of war out. You know, like, and I'll be honest with you, that I'm very drawn to the hermit life. A hermit, you know, is what I would be if I had the financial resources. it's my desire, but it doesn't seem to be my karma or fate in this life, which is fine. You know, like, I'm fine with that. But the reason I'm very drawn to hermit life is that on those occasions when I have been in a hermit, I have really been able to access the divine presence, you know, like, or feel its presence, or be completely open to its grace, you know, like, and not just in flashes, but like for hours and hours and even like an entire day, you know, like, and I'm unable to do that in everyday life. And I know that you're supposed to be able to do that. I've been told that countless times. But I have to be honest, you know, like, that that I get distracted, you know, like, and so that's That's my own tug of war, but I began to think of it as a creative friction, not necessarily a bad thing that friction is there. But I thought I wanted to talk about. I'm not going to talk a lot about my journey. I practiced Buddhism for a long time, but I have ended up in the Quaker tradition, and I thought that I discovered this book called A Guide to True Peace, which is a manual of Quaker contemplation, and I'd just like to read one short section from it, because I think it speaks very much to the topic that we're discussing tonight. See, the Quakers are a contemplative tradition, but they have no monastic heritage. You know, like they've always been, you know, lay people. So this manual was published in the originally published in the early 1800s, and then it's been in continuous print ever since. But it's based on a lot of older material. This is from chapter one, which is "The Spirit of God dwells in the heart of man. So we must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, that in this profound silence of the whole soul, we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still, small voice. It is not indeed a voice uttered in words, as when a man speaks to his friend, but it is a perception infused by the secret operations and influences of the divine spirit, insinuating to us obedience, patience, meekness, humility, and all the other Christian virtues in a language perfectly intelligible to the attentive soul. But how seldom is it that the soul keeps itself silent enough for God to speak? The murmurs of our vain desires and our self-love disturb all the teachings of the divine spirit. Ought we then to be surprised if so many persons, apparently devout, but too full of their own wisdom and confidence in their own virtues, are not able to hear it, and that they look upon this internal word as the chimera of fanatics. The external word, even of the gospel, would be but an empty sound without this living and fruitful word in the interior to interpret and open it to the understanding." So, for me, discovering the Quaker tradition has been kind of a way I bridged these two worlds. You know, like, so that weekly immersion in group silence, silent worship, silent prayer, nourishes me. It's like, reminds me of that divine presence. And I just wanted to touch on, we were talking about, all three of us have been talking about the difficulties of living a contemplative life in this culture at this time, and I just wanted to give a few thoughts about why it's difficult at this time, you know, like, and one is that the culture we're in at this time is, I would call it, cynical about that, the existence of that presence. Like that, it doesn't really believe it, you know, like, and so it's hard to get around that. So when I say that it's cynical about it, what I mean is that there's a tendency, if you want to go on that path, that others will psychologize that yearning into a neurosis. You know, like what you're really doing is evading, you know, some problem that you have. You know, like, and And so it will reinterpret that. It's a very, very common strategy. You know, and it's difficult if people are not secure, if they don't have an experience of that divine presence that's secure and well-grounded. It's actually difficult for people to understand what's going on. And I feel many people have been deflected from following a spiritual path by this kind of reconfiguration. Mm-hmm. And another strategy is to ideologically interpret a yearning for the divine, so that what you're really doing is imposing your leisure, you know, which is a class, privilege upon others. And you're taking advantage of your situation. This is a very common interpretation of religious yearning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very widespread, and it has mm-hmm. both very gross and subtle forms. So I think those ways are particularly modern. Those ways of reconfiguring a spiritual yearning are particularly strong in the modern world today, and difficult to cut through. If you are confronted with them, if you have a spiritual yearning. The first one about the cynicism is that from the point of view of, say, a commercial society, you are wasting your time. Mm-hmm. It's not productive. No matter how much you pray and how much you meditate and how much scripture you study or whatever you're doing, it's not going to give you a promotion. You can't run for office, by informing people that you sit and stare at a wall for an hour a day. There are times in history where it would have been considered a plus. So those kinds of things create barriers to the entry into the spiritual realm. Friends might worry about you. If you go off in that direction, and the worry will be sincere. And the other thing is that following a spiritual path today, or a contemplative path, to me, the heart of it is renunciation. You can't follow a spiritual path without engaging in renunciation. And what I mean by that, I don't mean becoming a stylite, sitting on a pillar or something like that, or a desert father who's fasting for incredible periods of time. What I mean is this: if you regularly engage in a spiritual practice, what you're doing is you're devoting a certain amount of time to activities which renounce a focus on material goods and benefits. And people spot that. You're wasting your time. Shouldn't you be doing something constructive? Depending on who they are and their relationship to you, they'll be more or less explicit about that. And that's just the position, that our culture is in at this time. There are effective answers to those issues that are raised, but I'm just saying that to me the stresses of trying to follow contemplative life are that the culture at large doesn't support it. So let me offer an analogy. In Europe during the 1700s, the whole culture, for some reason, was really interested in music. Music was huge, and so you could get ahead, your family could get ahead, by having your children become musicians or composers or conductors or something like that. And so you had this huge, population of musicians and composers and conductors and instrument makers, it was a big deal. And so during that period, you had just this incredible flourishing of music. And it was, no one knows exactly why that happened at that time, but it did. You know, like, there are times in history when following a spiritual path has been similarly seen as something of worth. I'm thinking, say, of Tang Dynasty China. You know, would be an example. You know, like where the culture at large recognized its value, so that if you wanted to go in that direction, even though it was unusual, the culture at large knew what you were doing. You know, like and thought that the and sort of said, oh, you know, like good. You know, like there's a temple over there, or there's a cave up there, or something like that. And we're not in that cultural situation. There's pluses and minuses to that. I'm not saying it's entirely a negative thing, but I believe it's a source of a lot of the friction. And I'll close by I'm going to close my comments by reading from an introduction to the Guide to True Peace, which was written in 1945 or 46, something like that, by a Quaker by the name of Howard Brenton. So this is, and he's talking about said the Guide to True Peace diagnoses our trouble and points out the remedy. It tells us that we are in trouble because, in learning how to control nature, we have neglected to learn how to control ourselves. You know, look within, not without, for the meaning and goal of life. Then he says, this solution will seem too simple to intellectuals and too inadequate to activists, the two groups that dominate our age. It will seem too simple to intellectuals, and it will seem too inadequate to activists. And those are the two groups that dominate our age. The intellectual seeks an answer in some system, philosophy or theology, some scheme of social or political reform. But our guide does not encourage us to seek ultimate truth solely through thinking. So I think Brenton was very insightful there. You know, like pointing out the solution of going within and leading the contemplative life will seem too simple to intellectuals and too inadequate to activists. I mean, the interesting thing about the Quaker tradition is that, considering its small numbers, it's had a huge impact, you know, like on society, you know, like, and that's an instructive lesson in itself. I mean, the Quakers were the primary originators of the anti-slavery movement in America and England, you know, like. Four of the five women who made the call at Seneca Falls were Quakers. Mm-hmm. And there's many other examples. So it's interesting that we feel so acutely this conflict between the contemplative life and life in the world, when historically that doesn't seem to actually be the case. You know, that there is that kind of conflict, that we feel like this conflict. And my final concluding remark is that I would like to just make the case for the hermit as such, right? That is, the hermit who really does go on retreat, you know, like some of the Desert Fathers, Anthony, right?
This one.
And some of the Chinese hermits, like Cold Mountain and Shan. My experience has been, when I've been in a hermitage, and I'm unable to explain this, but when I am filled by the grace of God and completely present to that grace, somehow that is the greatest gift I can give to humanity. Mm-hmm. that nothing else I can do in my life surpasses that. Mm-hmm. And I know that is difficult to understand. It's even difficult for me to say it because it sounds, outlandish at some level. But I would like to say that I greatly admire St. Francis and his work with the poor, and I greatly admire the Quakers and their work in the world. They have improved the world, and I think the world would be a better place if everybody took their bodhisattva vows. But I also think that there's a place in this world for the genuine hermit and the hermit mm-hmm. who is really completely present to that presence, and that's all that hermit does. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we were hoping to open it up to your inquiry. Question?
I would like to ask you what your fraternity actually does besides meet once a month.
You
How do they try to follow St. Francis' teaching example?
That's a really good question, because we're in a transformative time in our group now. We've had some shifts in membership, a new election, and we've met once a month in prayer. People, individuals in the group are involved in different work in their communities, but as a group, once a year we serve a Handy Capables luncheon, but as a group we're not real visible right now, and that is, in the time of Francis, he and his followers were quite visible, and they were, shakers and movers. And I think our present Pope Francis is trying to give us an example of how to be shakers and movers again. So, we're not doing a lot as a group right now, and I'm hoping that as a group in the next year or two that's going to change. But ideally it would be, having some activities as a group, being out in the community more and just being of service. Mm-hmm.
So the meetings you have now are more of the contemplative end, not the activist end.
Right, right.
Both of these things.
Right, yeah. And see, I had the opportunity to be in Albuquerque for 6 years, where a Franciscan, Richard Rohr, has done a lot of work. He started a center, and he was a teacher of mine out there. And they so much emphasize, they have a center for action and contemplation. Mm-hmm. So they so much emphasize how both of those mm-hmm. are part of the Franciscan way. And I think individuals in our group are active, but as a Franciscan group, we're not visibly active. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for that question.
Yeah. I just wanted to share, I love this, coming here and just hearing this, because it kind of just verifies and affirms things that I've experienced, and I kind of did everything backwards. I had my guru, and I did my meditation every morning, every night, tried to do service all day long, which meant just meditating and going to work, etc. It's really funny, because then after 12 heavy years of being very rigid about doing this activity, and I felt a lot of grace, but what I saw was, I was very, and I always feel this way about sometimes this area, there's a lot of pseudo-spiritualists running around, and it's really hard, and I And then I had a head-on car collision. And so I basically got turned. I was basically forced to concentrate on my physical renewal. And so I, all of a sudden I realized, oh, where's my relationship? Where's my love? Where am I doing? Am I serving this, you know? And I realized I wasn't really meditating that much. And so now I feel like I've gone back to it, but it feels like it's totally, like it feels so much gentler with everybody and everything in my life, and I'm making peace with the imperfection that I have and the maniac that I really am, and I'm starting not to reject it so much or think I have to be this way or that way. Sometimes I am crude and disruptive and argumentative, but I'm starting to make peace with all that and to see that the imperfection is part of the perfection. Love it, you know? And so anyway, I'm just thankful that I feel like you guys are like food for, I'm trying not to think, because I've always been very great with that. And it's not to my benefit, but anyway, thank you for letting me speak and just feel like good.
Well, I wanted to respond to the embracing of the imperfections. It's a big one. And it's interesting that in the hermit life, or when I'm in at the center, there's enough holding of the grace that when the negative emotions arise, the imperfections arise, I can meet it with so much more skill and openness that I just do not have at my fingertips in everyday life. And that to me is one of the main disconnects for me in coming down the mountain, where, because I go into retreat at least two, maybe twice a year for a week or so, and coming down the mountain and entering life and losing it, and negative emotions arise and acting incredibly unskillfully, is something that is harder for me to hold in the world than it is in my hermitage. So that's part of the training, I believe, in bringing this grace that you spoke of so beautifully, that we find up there. How do we bring this out in the world when, to me, it feels like the rug just gets pulled out from under my feet over and over again. And of course, I do remember Ram Dass's beautiful words for this spiritual journey. The spiritual journey is you take your step forward and then you fall flat on your face. And then you pick yourself up and you brush yourself off. And that's it. Step, fall, up, brush, step, fall, up, brush. And that's the spiritual journey. And that's very hard to accept. And so this grace that we find up there, how are we bringing? Are we being of service? Are we bringing into the world when you scream at your child? That, or I lost it with my mother on Monday. She's in a nursing home, and she was very difficult. And for 5.5 years, I've been very patient, and I lost it. And I just wheeled her back, and I said, "I can't handle her. Take her." And then I promptly went to the hallway and cried because it was just a nut falling flat on my face. And and then, you know, accepting that and then for the first time leaving her without telling her I loved her. What if she died? She's getting pretty close to it, you know. So where's my service? Where am I, where can I bring more skillfulness into my life?
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this is good. Did you have time to say, did you say anything to her about it?
Well, she's in dementia, so it's hard to communicate. That was part of the frustration. But I did go to the hallway and said, I love you. You know, I do believe that you can communicate on other planes than in person. So when after I finished crying and finished being mad at myself, then I could say, I love you, Mom.
Don't you think there was a part of her that probably went, oh, good, she told me. Don't you think there was a part of her that loved that? That you could be real with her?
Yeah, possibly. That's true. I have tried to be a perfect daughter for way too long.
Right.
I think that's part of my contemplation. Do we all need to go off and be nourished? Maybe I'm acting less skillfully because I haven't been on retreat for a few months. I really don't know the answer to that. I don't know if that, I really love that Jim brought this up because you believe that it is very important to do this. And there's a part of me that's saying, I want to find out how to do that here in this world.
Yeah. I just want to make a comment about that and also what you're speaking about. I remember a long time ago, I had gone through a divorce and I was in Santa Barbara, and I remember going into the mission there and asking if I was supposed to join a religious community, you know, like a monastic community or an order of nuns or something. And I very clearly heard this voice saying, go into the world needs spiritual people and it's really hard. And I know Ginny and I, after a dance class one time, were talking about, you know, those of us who are making commitments to focus our spiritual practice more, we still find that the people that are in those groups are, there's difficult times. Mm. Remember that conversation we were having, and you think, oh, these people are going to act differently because they've made this commitment. But we all fall short. And so you bringing up that whole thing of our imperfections, I think, is so important, and the gentleness, and, you know, that whole thought that we're trying. All of us are here because we're trying. We're trying to do something that's different, that's just our hearts. You know, it's from our hearts. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking about this. And that little piece is going to be honored by our divine, you know. And I think, you know, I would love to be a hermit too. I love going to our family cabin in the woods and just having the quiet time. But I haven't heard any call to stay there, you know, and it's very interesting. And there are people, I think, that very much are called to stay there and do what you were talking about. But I've always been called back, although, you know, that could change, but so far.
I always wonder if I'm sorry, this is the last thing I'll say. But I always wonder if there's something besides the spiritual people that go on a spiritual retreat, married people, because I'm single, I don't have children, I'm disabled to the, so not being able to use my gifts, like what I learned to do with my hands and with my brain, and it leaves me feeling like I don't have service, I'm dying. What do I do? And people always say, just let your spirit be your service. But I feel like I want something physical. I want to know that I'm contributing a little part to this world. I guess my question is, Well, the answer come to me, or I'm just going to live the rest of my life wondering what I'm supposed to do when I grow up. Mm. You know? Some, tell me something.
You could pray.
I know, I can. Mm-hmm.
You could pray.
And ask specifically what I just asked.
Mm-hmm.
You?
You prayer is a wonderful path.
And if you just think about being your light.
I'm thinking that too.
Being your light. And I have seen your light. I see you around town. There's a light there.
Yes.
You're pretty special.
I find it.
So that's a service. You want to do that?
Jim, I remember one time in one of our classes you said that there were two kinds of hermits, those who loved people and those who hated people. Which one would you be?
Nice, Bruce. Putting me on the spot. What Bruce is referring to is that when I was an abbot sometimes people would come to me and they would want to be a hermit, or you know, they would want to go in that direction. And one of the things I would discern is, did they want to be a hermit because human beings disgusted them, you know, and repulsed them? And if I picked that up, I would say, not a good idea. It's you know, you will become sour. And you, in your hermitage, you will simply nourish that feeling of disgust and repulsion. You know, like, so I like to say the hermit way, let's see if I can remember this, consists of five aspects, you know, silence, stillness, stability, simplicity, and intention. The first four are kind of objective practices that you can cultivate, you know, like, and the fifth one, though, is an interior examination, you know, like, Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov illustrates this with two hermits. I think the good hermit is Father Zosima. I mean, it's been many years since I read it, in fact, decades since I read it, but that's my recollection. And he is a hermit because he's filled with the love of God. It's that God drew him to the hermitage, you know, like, and everybody that, I mean, he's a hermit, but in the Russian style, you know, there's always people visiting him, you know, like, and that's what happens to a certain kind of hermit, you know, like, Anthony was like that, one of the early desert fathers. He kept having to pack up and go deeper into the desert. All these people would, you know, knock on his door, and they'd say, Father, give me a word.
You know,
like, so.
Go away.
No, he never did that. He never did that. And then in The Brothers Karamazov, there's this other hermit, his name I can't remember, but who's just this sour, cranky, bitter, you know, person who has missed out on life and can tell you meticulously about just what he's missed. And so that's extremely important, you know, like, the being a hermit here for Americans, I like to put it this way: being a hermit is not about being self-sufficient. Many Americans configure the hermit life as being a life of self-sufficiency, you know, like, so and there's no such thing as a self-sufficient life, you know, like, because everything you get is a gift from God, you know, like, you haven't, you know, like, and if you read the lives of hermits, there's always some character around bringing them food, you know, like, or or water or something, you know, like, even the anchorites in the Middle Ages, you know, were regularly contacted. So, you know, like, my point is that that kind of discernment is extremely important, you know, like, for for a life as a hermit, that isn't just a field for stewing in one's own neuroses. You know, like, you know, people don't recognize me, so I'm going to pack up, you know, like, and go off. I mean, you don't always have to use religious examples. Think of someone like Emily Dickinson. You know, like, I mean, she was, you know, she lived a very reclusive life. You know, like, but none of the contemporary records about her talk about bitterness or, you know, anger or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And she wrote her, you know, 1,700 poems virtually unknown. I mean, what's interesting is when you read her poems, there are hundreds, at least hundreds of references to hymns, biblical passages in there. She was saturated with that, you know, like, and I think her poetry was her way of accessing the presence of the divine, you know, like, let's see if I can remember one of her poems is, exaltation is the going of the landed soul to sea, past the houses, past the highways, into deep eternity. Raised as we were among the mountains, can a sailor understand the divine intoxication of that first league out from land? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, to me, that's an expression of that she was able to, in her solitude, she was able to take that first league out from land, you know, like, and it was a great gift for everyone that she did so. I find the life of Emily Dickinson, for example, very archetypal of the hermit, in the sense of she cobbled her life together. She didn't have a rule that was handed to her. You know, like, the historians think that at a regular time every day she went up to this room. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it, but I've seen a picture. Her desk was about like this big.
It was probably about that big.
Yeah, you know, right.
It was smaller back then.
In front of a window, which looked out on her backyard, mm-hmm. and her backyard connected with the graveyard for, what was the city that she was in?
Amherst.
So, you know, like, and that's where that's all she needed, you know, was this table, some paper, a pencil. She wrote in pencil, not in ink, you know, so she could erase when she was revising, you know. I mean, in a way, she practiced a form of what in the Christian tradition are called the hours. You know, like, I mean, she set aside a certain time, you know, like, to do this. And she did it regularly, you know, like, and generated this. So a Chinese example of that would be Han Shan, you know, like, who went off to the mountains. His poems, the 300 poems that were collected of Han Shan, Han Shan means called mountain. Are people familiar with Han Shan? Yeah? No? No? Han Shan was a Tang Dynasty poet. You know, like, Tang Dynasty was 600 to 900, something like that. Yeah. In China. And his poems were graffiti. That he would go into town and he would, you know, to pick up some goods or, you know, on his errand, and he would write these poems on the wall, you know, on walls, you know, like, and it was the governor who recognized the quality of these poems and started, you know, telling people that they should be written down and gathered, you know, like, so, I mean, there's another example of someone who, like I said, cobbled together his life, and in a way, I think that's our situation in the modern world, you know, like, I mean, that's one of the reasons I find Emily Dickinson inspiring, because even though she, you know, she lived a modern life for those times, you know, like, she did not become a member of a religious order, she did not become a renunciate. Well, in a way, she did become a renunciate, but what I mean is she didn't take vows. She didn't take formal vows, you know, like. But she, you know, and in her letters you can read, I mean, it was a difficult negotiation. You know, it wasn't easy for her to sort through the various pulls and frictions that the world, you know, there was just as many distractions for her. And you know, she had her problems with her family, you know, like that we all have, you know, like, but she was able to sort of, somehow sort of winnow all that out and keep her focus, you know, like, and the whole world is better off, you know, for her having done that. And that's kind of what I mean by the hermit, you know, in her case, that was a real gift, you know, like, for, thank you, for asking.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Emily, a woman, mm-hmm. because in our usual idea of a hermit tradition, it's usually, certainly, it's been a male tradition, except for that period in medieval Europe when women could go into, like they got walled off.
Julian of Norwich.
Right, Julian of Norwich. But you reminded me of Rengetsu, who was another beautiful hermit who, when you said Anthony had to move around, Rengetsu had to keep moving around because people were demanding of her, and she needed that solitude. She needed that hermit cave or house, so she kept moving her hut. And it what I you could tell from her poetry that that was what was nurturing her. But it was after a very full life with partner and children and death, and she came to that traditional Asian time where you get to be a renunciate. You get to go to that cabin up. Your householder, your duties are done, and you can go. And that and the culture supported that.
Right.
Does the culture support that for us?
See, that's one of the things that, you know, in that list of distractions I was talking about, you know, like, if you look at commercials that are aimed for people who are 60s or plus, the uniform message is, you don't have to be old. You can be just like someone in their 20s or 30s, you know, like, if you use this or if you use that, instead of seeing the later years as that opportunity to enter into a more contemplative time of life.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit about a Taoist perspective on this. One of the things that strikes me about what all of you are saying and about the nature of spiritual practice in our culture now, which I agree with the feelings that you're describing. We live in a culture also that is an either-or culture. It sees either a contemplative life or a life in the world. And it's hard to see that they can be interrelated. So the Taoist approach to this, I think, would be along the lines of yin and yang, which are not either-or polarities. They're polarities that are connected intimately with each other, that the contemplative life, as you were describing, for a healthy hermit, has to be, in some sense, connected with the world, with, that is, love of other people, for example. Or the active life as an activist, a good activist, has to come from inner experience. And in the traditional yin-yang symbol with the white and the little black circle and so on, these things in that worldview are connected, so that we, if we try to, I think if we try to look at our contemplative experience as not something that we just try to have a little bit of whenever we can grab it, you know, or we can go on retreat, or we can even be a hermit for several years, but as part of a balance and a moving back and forth that occurs naturally between the two. Even as a hermit, you have to farm and cook your own food, you know, and do work. You, unless you're a very wealthy hermit, which seems like a contradiction in terms of how. So, I think, in my own practice, it's been really helpful to meditate on all the time, essentially, mm-hmm. on the yin and yang of things. That so every year I go to the Eastern Sierras for 10 days or so with my wife, and we go in November because there is no one there. And it is a wonderful retreat. And the skill is to try to bring that, not just to bring it back for a day or two, or you, when you come back, there is that shock, you know, you got to deal with all of this. But to just let it be a part of it. It's not an either or. It's an either and. The two are connected. And I don't know how to explain how for me it's become easier over 20 years of going to the Sierras every year, for example, and coming back. But I find life in a really dysfunctional and ugly culture to be easier than it used to be, partly because I ignore as much of that as I can. But I worked in the financial district for 25 years in San Francisco, and I was, as I think several, I think maybe all of you have said, I was considered an oddball because I was running a securities firm, and we were reading Taoist texts there, you know, and that kind of thing. But it can be done, and it's not always easy. But the ordinary life, maybe not the current ordinary life that most people live here, but the ordinary life that the people in this room are living, can be integrated with the life of a hermit, in my opinion.
Did you want to share?
We have one more, I
one
think,
more
before
speak.
we have to close.
Did she want to share?
Laura, right? Isn't it?
Oh, first I just want to say I agree with what you just said.
Dwight.
And that what occurred to me as you were speaking is that it's a matter of getting rid of our preferences of holding on to some state as if that's the only way to be, mm-hmm. and recognizing that our states ebb and flow. And the other thing that occurred to me was perhaps we look in the wrong direction when we're looking at our society. Because none of the great hermits we knew ever had the permission of the society or the support of the society. And actually, it doesn't matter to me whether the society supports a contemplative life or not. It's the life I'll live. When I'm living it, I live it. And I don't know that it's helpful for us to look at the fact that the society doesn't support it, because we're each going to blaze our trail. And we may never get support from it, and that will only make the yearning and the commitment stronger. So God bless the society for being as dysfunctional as it is. It continues to give me the ability to discriminate between what I see and what I know to be true from inside, you know, so they can all go to H in a handbag and it's fine.
I think you were talking about young people entering the path, were you?
About
how difficult it was to enter the path, because of, I wasn't sure whether you were talking
because
about
of the culture the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the analogy I would say, I mean, I don't disagree with what Laura said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that, as I mentioned in my talk, that there are actually pluses to our situation. It's not it's not just a minus, which is kind of what the point that Dwight was making. The every yin situation has a touch of yang, and every yang situation has a touch of yin. You know, like, so, but, as Jenny has suggested, that we're in a situation which is kind of new for people who want to pursue a contemplative path, and we have to figure it out on our own. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, like, but it does mean that the templates we've inherited from the past for following a contemplative path won't necessarily match our social situation. And when I was offering these reasons, you know, like when I was analyzing
right.
society's attitude, it has helped me, because of the kind of mind I have, to gain some clarification about just what is going on when there's an attempt to deflect, you know, like, from the pursuit of that. Some people won't need that kind of analysis, I recognize that, but because I am the kind of person I am, I needed to investigate that and see, you know, like, what were they saying and why were they saying it, and it helped me to be more secure about
that. I just want to say, understanding it is different than expecting it to ever change.
Oh, got that.
So I think we do need to conclude.
I would like to add a footnote to that, though, because I disagree with her. It's true enough that if somebody has that kind of passion and they want to be a contemplative, they'll find a way to do it. But there are also a lot of people who have that desire who don't have that kind of strength, with some encouragement might in fact find themselves in the middle of a contemplative practice. So I think that's important to note, that just not just the people who have that absolute deep burning desire, but people who have a penchant without that deep burning desire.
Okay.
Thank you.
All
this
right.
was rich. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, panelists, for this wonderful discussion. I really appreciate it. So thank you, Kathleen Robiano, Kathleen Fekiu Miosho of Virginia Matthews. Thank you, Jim Wilson.
You're
this
welcome.
Has been great. I have, before you leave, I have the permit sign-up sheet here. You can write down the you're leaving behind and indicate the direction you seek to travel. I'll be over there on the desk, along with the donation bowl, to help support this space and the work of our esteemed panelists who have done such a wonderful job tonight. To me, this was the start of a conversation that
mm-hmm.
I'd love to have continue again in the future. That was productive, and there's so much more we can talk about this. It's fantastic.
And there are books up there as well.
And
no.
that's the final point
yeah.
that I need to make. So I thank you all for coming. Is that Stuart the Truth Teller, No Hermit to Transactions, reminds me that these books here are for your contemplation. To be able to contemplate them, you might want to give us some money in return. That would be a transaction. We would appreciate that, and we feel that you would appreciate it as well. We certainly appreciate your coming out on this brisk evening.
Last day of Hanukkah, right?
The last day of Hanukkah, I believe. And
yes.
Was it
the last?
I believe that's correct. And we look forward to seeing you again, hopefully next week for Waiting for Mary, and possibly for other events here as well, this month and in 2014. Oh,
may
Many
I
Rivers.
Mention an event? That's
oh, please go ahead.
Just in case you're interested in Franciscan spirituality, there's a, on December 21st in Occidental from 9 to 3, one of our Franciscans, Keith Warner, who's done a lot of environmental studies and links spirituality and the environment, is going to be presenting. So I forgot to bring a flyer in. But anyway, if...
is that the Arts and Ecology?
It's going to be at St. Philip Church, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's for a whole 6 hours?
It's a day of reflection, and it's open to anyone who's interested in Franciscan spirituality or how we connect our spirituality in the care of creation now. Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
So,
thank you so much, and thank you all for coming tonight, my neighbors.
Thank you.
And thank you for the tea.
You're welcome.